If you're a sports fan, you've heard this guy's voice. If you haven't, you will. He's been the lead sportscaster for college football for ESPN since, 2019, Sean?
Yeah, just a little over a year now.
Of course, he was worked with me for a number of years, an SIU alum, and has been building every single day since he left Southern Illinois to accomplish more and more, whether it's NBA broadcasts, Major League Baseball, college football, and he's been very busy. Got a lot of questions. First off, morning, Sean. I hope you're well, man.
Morning. I'm doing even better now. It's great to hear your voice and great to talk to you again, of course.
It is, too. It's weird. I was going through the closet, during the quarantine, and I found that shirt you bought me for your 21st birthday.
Oh, my gosh.
I still have it in the closet. Sean made me the shirt. I took him out for his 21st birthday for St. Patrick's Day in Murfreesboro, and he's never forgiven me since.
I hurt until I was 22, I think.
Sean, being a sports guy, being able to go out and you get your equipment, right? You fly, you travel, whatever the case, whether it's high school or college or NBA, you've got this thing, right? You got your package. You get out the door. You make sure on time. You do your homework. You're prepared. And you're immersed in what's going on in the court. You don't always have that now. How do you deal with that?
It's the strangest thing. And it was funny because, Tom, I was thinking about you and, our days together literally this past weekend, because I did my first ever national network broadcast from my house. I did college football and NFL football on the radio this past Saturday and Sunday from my house. And quite frankly, it was the hardest thing I'd done since when I started back doing high school football in Southern Illinois. Not only the challenges of, maybe you have to string a phone line from the gym over the parking lot through the concession stand and set up your equipment in a press box and here's a roster and go. That's kind of what it felt like. It kind of took me back to the challenges of broadcasting remotely, but from places that aren't equipped to do so. And that brought me all back to where it all started, frankly, this past weekend.
So you have to do even more homework because you don't have – you're being fed in many things. I mean, you're right there, on the sidelines. Let's talk basketball. It's an easier one, I think, to understand. And you get to direct where your eyes are going and what you can see and what you can derive for it and describe. But in this case, the cameraman is telling you what you need to describe.
In that sense, yes, and that director has all the power, and that's what I found out through football this past weekend. Thankfully for me, the NBA side was somewhat normal this year because the NBA wanted the national broadcasters on site in Orlando. So on three different occasions, I went down for a stretch in the bubble in Orlando and did the games on site. So that part was familiar. Everything else about it was not, but when you start to broadcast remotely, as so many are doing now, yes, you're at the mercy of not only what the director is cutting, that's the term they use for going shot to shot, but also what feeds you're able to get at your house. Are you going to get the one feed that everybody sees on television, or are you going to get that feed and then say what they call, like in football, the all-22, which would be a stationary camera that shows the whole field and doesn't move? Or like if you're doing a baseball game, some of my colleagues call that the high nine. So that's the camera that would be above home plate from behind it that would show the entire field so you could see where all the fielders are shifting and whatnot. So all those things are now out of your control, and you have to be able to adapt and adjust. And maybe Tom, you're not able to do the same job you've always done, but at the same time, you may see things that you never saw before. So that part is intriguing, too.
I'm wondering about this, and I'm glad you brought it up. When you're at home doing a broadcast, do you only see a singular feed, or do you see two or three options so that you've got a kind of an overall view? I mean, what are you seeing when you're fed this material at home?
Yeah, this was all new to me this past weekend. So, for instance, I had Florida and Ole Miss on Saturday for college football. And that was an ESPN television game as well. So for us at ESPN Radio, we had the ability to have several of their camera feeds that would go back to that television truck that they would cut up. So I had what folks would see on TV. I also had, like I said, that all-22 cam. And then I had, one other feed that would come in and out with regard to maybe a shot of the benches, that kind of a thing. But then yet on Sunday with the NFL, I really only had one feed to work with. And that's what they call, these are all kind of TV broadcast terms, but It's called the dirty feed. They're the dirty backhaul, basically, which is what you would see at home on TV, but yet no commercials. So I would see everything that was going on during the breaks or timeouts that you wouldn't see at home. So that's what I had to deal with. And so you don't find that out until maybe an hour before kickoff in this case. And then you're like, okay, well, this will be interesting. You know, hopefully the director or whoever decides not to maybe cut away from a shot too quick. And then I think that some honesty and transparency has to come into the broadcast too, Tom, and that I think it's okay for us on the air to say, hey, I'm doing this from home. I didn't see that, or that's not on my feed.
Right.
I'll let you know as soon as I get that information, and not try and be dishonest or fake your way through it, because then you'll really be working out of a hole at that point.
I think it also builds a level of empathy with the viewer, knowing that you're in the same seat that they are. Because, you know, sports, and I've been saying this for a number of months now, sports has an opportunity right now. I don't know if it was fully capitalized on, but you just kind of talked about this. I'm at home like you are. I'm dealing with this. I'm going to find it. I'm going to be honest, right? That's your credibility, which you and I both know, right? It's what we live on, right? But at the same time, sports and getting out there, and you remember post 9/11 baseball, Jack Buck. I mean, sports had an opportunity. Do you think that they really took advantage of that because of the health concerns when they could have been a leader in this country when it comes to morale?
I think some teams, some leagues have done better than others. And I do agree with you that it's truly a touchstone for all of us, those moments, not only just to the ability to enjoy a game, but there's this communal spirit that goes along with all of us either being at a sporting event together or sharing remotely while all of us have something to distract ourselves with or take enjoyment in, you know, even from our own homes. And so it's interesting, isn't it, Tom? I mean, we went so many months without having anything really to watch. I mean, there was this vast wasteland of stuff that we were all either trying to
Tiger King
watch or, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, Tiger King for everybody.
Back, and now we've got NBA postseason, the NHL wrapped up last night. You've got football on both accounts and Major League Baseball all going at the same time, not to mention golf and tennis and everything else.
Right.
So now we're being overloaded. So if you're a sports fan, it's a great time. But at the same time, it's also kind of overwhelming in the same sense.
So after listening to you talk, I kind of get the sense, Sean, that you're going to say being inside the NBA bubble and being down on the floor was worth it.
It was worth it. Not only was it a chance to kind of have a front row seat to history, frankly, but in a lot of ways, the NBA bubble turned into not just a sporting event, but somewhat of a science project as to how we could pull something off collectively in the face of a pandemic, and what that might mean for how we could do other kinds of events too. And for that matter, the NBA had a large hand in helping to develop a new set of testing, whether it be a more rapid way of testing or even a more accurate way that will now help out schools and businesses across the country. That was a byproduct of putting this all together and the hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent on that quote-unquote science project. To the NBA's credit, Tom, they pulled it off. And out of all the other leagues in Major League Sports, that one always seems to have their act together. That one always seems to have the best relationship between the owners and the Players Association. And therefore, you'd have to say it was a rousing success. And they're now headed for the NBA Finals tomorrow night. So they're literally 2 weeks away from pulling this thing off.
You know, it's interesting. If you were listening a couple of moments ago, Sean and I'm not sure how many years it's been, but when Sean uses the words, that should be interesting, he's been using that phrase since I met him and he was quite young. And you have to listen closely to the inflection, because that should be interesting means it could be interesting, or it means we're screwed. Anywhere in between, you have to listen very closely to his inflection, because he doesn't want to say what he wants. Well, that should be interesting, and that's where it ends. So you got to listen to the inflection there. You know, sound is important, and that was the other thing that I think is missing. It's kind of creepy when you watch some of this material, and what was it, a week ago? Philadelphia? They were piping in the sound in their home stadium, and they piped in boos for their own quarterback. I mean, or the absence of sound when you're a broadcaster and you're there. And they're the only reason I'm watching baseball is occasionally watch Geddy Lee of Rush to be on the, you know, behind the, you know, batter. You know, the crowd's gone. You know, there's a there is a group phenomenon that you feed on. You feel it. You know what the crowd's thinking. You make that part of your broadcast. It's gone.
Well, yes, and at the same time, it's also kind of this mind trick a little bit. I mean, I was thinking back to some of my first games down in Orlando at that bubble. You're in this small arena. It's really a made-for-television set, almost. It's like the greatest reality show of all time. And, Tom, I remember, you know, I would put my headsets on, the crowd noise would come in, you'd have the sounds of the game, and you'd hear more of those than ever before because there are no fans. And you'd be calling the game, and you would be tricked, whether you're the listener or even the broadcaster, into believing that all this is real. Yes, the game's real, the players are real, the competition's real, but the atmosphere is not. And then, so halftime would come along, and you'd take your headsets off, and now you're in an empty room, basically. And it's like you're just like this like giant suction right out of a video game or something,
right,
back into reality. Or you'd have a great game and a big call, and the teams would leave the floor, and you'd walk out the building, and there are no cars. There are no fans leaving the building.
Yeah.
It's dead silent.
No bratwurst.
It is the most surreal feeling.
No popcorn, no beer, and I never even thought about that when you get into that situation. With social justice becoming such a major part of sports across the board on this, has that caused you any change in the way you broadcast, a certain level of caution, of making sure that you're properly representing what is going on, understanding there's a lot of people of a lot of different considerations watching? How's that affect your broadcast?
It affected the broadcast in the sense that you have to, you have to quote-unquote report on what is going on and what is occurring not only with these players and these coaches, but also this balance between the outside world and what these players and coaches are enduring in a high-profile role. And so there's this thing about being a 48-year-old white guy in what you say and what you don't say, but more importantly, in how you listen and how you acknowledge things that maybe you had never thought about before, why it's so important to them, why they want their platform to be used in perhaps a way they've never themselves been able to do or been willing to do. And you want to encourage them as a fellow human being, and you want to be empathetic to all those involved. So this giant mix of things that hopefully you can play some small role in all of us hoping to be better, but without stepping out of your boundaries or getting over your skis a little too much.
Right.
I think that I've learned a lot going along, and I think that I've tried to find the right balance. And I think I've also, learned more about myself and what I did know and what I didn't know about what is going on in our society and how it's affecting the population in different corners.
And you know what? I don't think there's a better guy for the job. I've known you well enough since you were young enough to know that you've always been a civil, insightful, factual person. So, I think there's a level of credibility that comes along with you when you do that and are able to achieve that balancing act, because the harsh fact is you're being judged as a proxy for the entire sport or that team.
I think some of that comes just from my experiences a little bit, and a lot of that goes back to when I first started with you. I mean, Tom, we were working in 1993. This is when I first met you, in January of 93. We're working at a rock and roll station in Murfreesboro, and the first two things I learned from you was, A, how to just stop and ask questions. You're always inquiring about a situation or the people that we're dealing with. And the other thing was, Tom, that I also learned from you and others in our community there in Southern Illinois how to, adapt and, I don't want to say fit in because that seems so trivial, but yet there's this ability that you have and others, you know, Mike Reese, a mutual friend of ours, and others that, you know, whether you're at the Street Machine Nationals or you're at a bar or you're on campus with a population that's come from all over the country, to be aware of your surroundings and not have a singular mindset with regard to an event or a conversation. And I think I've leaned on some of those things, and I also have, I guess, matured enough to know that I don't know everything, and there are things that I've learned here in the past few months, as I'm sure many in our country have, that we didn't know either, A, because we'd never asked, or B, because we just weren't in the same situation that they were and were unaware of some of these injustices and struggles that we thought were either in the past or we never knew of that certainly are relevant still today.
Yeah, being open to what's going on around you. You just got to be open to it. Yeah,
yes.
And not shut down yourself. It's interesting. Sean Kelly's joining us, ESPN broadcaster, SIU alum. It's interesting that the debate, you know, was in Cleveland tonight, and you and I did, a three-day broadcast in Cleveland, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I was talking about earlier this morning. Everybody talks, oh, Cleveland's terrible. Cleveland's great, man. What are you talking about? We had a blast.
It's really a progressive city, and it does get a bad rap. And funny how a lot of these big events have found themselves to Cleveland over the years. It'll be fascinating tonight. It really will be, and I'm looking forward to watching it. I think last year, Tom, didn't we know that 84 million people watched the first debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
I believe so.
That number may go down tonight. I think that many people are engaged right now, and that's a good thing for our country.
Yeah, and Cleveland, a good place to do it. So what do you see going forward? When it comes to broadcasting, has it permanently changed for sports? Are we waiting this thing out, or will we see this have a permanent effect on, say, some broadcasters, not saying ESPN, but some broadcaster syndicate saying, look, we can save a lot of money by keeping this guy at home in his basement in the sound booth doing the play-by-play. Are we going to see an age where when a stadium doesn't sell out, that there'll be cutouts placed in those seats to give it the appearance? I'm thinking about Marlins, right, watching baseball and how they always keep the camera on the field because you don't want to see there's nobody in the stands, nobody there.
Yeah.
What do you see? Do you see a long-term effect on COVID-19 professional sports broadcasting and what we see in here on radio and TV?
I think there's a long-term effect, but I don't think it's what we're seeing at the moment. I think there'll be some kind of adjustment that, you know, a lot of these networks and really the smaller regionals too have been hemorrhaging money throughout all of this. And so there is a cost benefit to perhaps not traveling as many broadcasters. But at the same time, I think we're also learning that as much as we've leaned on technology and been able to pull this off in some form or fashion, there's still a place for being there and able to have conversations with coaches and players in person and being able to feel the event. And so I think that, you know, eventually, like the rest of our country, when we get to a point where we have a vaccine, it's more safe to do some of these things that will swing back toward what we know is normal. But yet I still do believe, Tom, as you mentioned, that there will be an effect on some regional networks, maybe even the nationals, that on occasion or for a certain tier of games, it will be more remote. And as far as crowds being back at games, we're seeing different states and municipalities allowing a certain number of folks back into the building. Look, part of the sporting event is the fan experience and all the smells and sounds and experiences go along with that, like tailgating here in the South. I mean, these people down here are going nuts because they can't tailgate in a football game.
Right.
When it's safe again, I think those things return. And just to touch on what you said about 9/11, you know, baseball games occurring in New York City, so close to that event, there was an unease with those fans being in a building of that size with that many people. But yet there was still this stepping out and saying, we have to come together as a community, and yes, there might be some risk, but at the same time, this is a part of who we are and what we need as a people. So that, too, will come back. I just don't know when that is. And anybody that tells you is wrong, because we're still seeing so much uncertainty.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. Sean Kelly, I got to tell you, every time I see, because I listen a bit of you doing Ole Miss, man, I got a charge out of it. And not because I enjoy the game. I got a charge out of you. I'm so proud to see, as Sean is better at remembering dates than I am, 1993 January that Sean and I met and worked together for a number of times, did a lot of stuff on the road. Like I said, went to Cleveland, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, did broadcast. Sean was at the table when he's like, I'm looking at his watch and going, I'm going to leave the room now. When I asked the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame officials when they were going to induct Head East, and they said, who? And Sean says, I'm going to leave now and go get I'll be right back after Tom finishes losing his on you, boys. So I think at that point he said, Well, this should be interesting, as we mentioned before. Sean, just incredibly.
Yeah, I use that phrase to cover, too.
And this should be interesting. But I got to tell you, exceedingly proud. And I know the people at Broadcasting SIU and Mike Reese and the others you worked are equally proud, because there's, you know, there's one thing about being proud of somebody. Is when you're proud of them, they go out on the road and they never embarrass you. They're always prepared and good to go. You know, I'm a nut about that stuff. And that's what I hear in your broadcast, and I enjoyed immensely.
Well, Tom, let's just be honest. That ring on your finger that I think you've worn since I've known you, I think you've wrapped it on my head a few times, because I wasn't always perfect, and I also did probably embarrass you at some point. So let's not forget that part of our past, too.
Well, don't worry, buddy. I know I embarrassed you more than once, too. I think we're back into Murphy's World St. Patrick's Day again now.
Look, while we're using the word proud, I go everywhere around the country saying how proud I am that I came through Southern Illinois and SIU. Because, look, as you know, but maybe others don't, our business is inundated with folks from Syracuse and Northwestern and other places. And I'm waving that SIU flag as much as I can, and I'm always rooting for us back home.